Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, the promise and perils of psychedelic psychiatry. Psychedelic drugs, long demonized as dangerous, are now being employed to treat conditions like PTSD and other mental disorders. I'll speak with two leaders in this emerging field, Dr. Rick Doblin of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies and Dr. Roland Griffiths of the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at Johns Hopkins Medicine. So that's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday on Foreign Affairs. My next guest is Krish Omara Vignaraja, the president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. She also served in the Obama administration as a senior advisor in the State Department and as a policy director for Michelle Obama, and she was a candidate for governor here in Maryland. Krish Vignaraja joins us today from Syracuse, New York. Krish, welcome back.
So nice to hear you. Thanks for having me, Tom.
So you heard perhaps a little bit of Melvin Goodman talking about Afghanistan. You wrote a piece in the Washington Post a week or so ago about this problem of Afghans who served as translators and drivers and guides. Give us a sense of the scope of this problem. How many people are we talking about, and what is their current status?
Yeah, so we're talking about 17 to 18,000 Afghan allies and their estimated 50,000 family members who are in what we call the Special Immigrant Visa Pipeline, the SIV pipeline. It was a program that was created to protect them and to resettle them. By law, we should take no longer than 9 months to process their applications. Unfortunately, the process has broken down. And so we have, you know, nearly 70,000 who are waiting closer to 3 years, if not longer. And obviously, we only have less than 3 months before the complete withdrawal of U.S. troops.
And how did this process break down? Why did it break down?
Yeah, so this has been a long time coming. So since 2002, Afghan nationals have worked alongside our U.S. troops, diplomats, as you mentioned. They've worked in roles ranging from translators, drivers, engineers, helping armed forces during the deployment. As a result of their faithful service, their lives and the lives of their families have been in grave danger. Hundreds have been killed already, and they continue to be targeted as more cities have fallen to the Taliban. We know that this is going to continue to accelerate in terms of the danger that they face. We made a commitment to them that because targets were painted on their backs as a result of their work for us, that we wouldn't leave them behind. And so it is both a moral but also a strategic imperative that we keep our word to them.
And the targets have been on their backs for a long time. This is not a new thing. This does not necessarily relate directly to the fact that the U.S. has announced that the troops are leaving. I mean, these targets existed when there were plenty of U.S. troops deployed in Afghanistan, right? This has been going on for a while.
It has. And unfortunately, we know that at least 300 allies have been targeted and killed for their allegiance to the U.S. So just in the last couple of weeks, just to give you one example, we had an interpreter. He had waited for over a decade in order to be resettled. During that time period, he had three family members who had been killed by the Taliban. And when he had been stopped at a military checkpoint, run by the Taliban, he was ultimately shot and killed in just the last couple of years in front of his son. His family has now been resettled to Houston, but this is just one of hundreds of examples of how these individuals, because they risked their lives and the lives of their families in order to help us, that as a result of that support in Afghanistan, they were put into the crosshairs of anti-American persecution.
Krish Omara Vignaraja is the president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. We're talking about U.S. obligations to the Afghans who assisted the U.S. military in our country's longest war. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWYPR. So, Krish, this SIV program, the Special Immigrant Visa Program, you write in the Post that there is a cap in this program of some 26,500 applicants. And as of December, just a few months ago, 6 months ago or so, there were a bunch, almost 11,000, that had gone unused. So there is this backlog, but there's some availability of these visas. What's it going to take to free them up and to give them to the people who need them?
Yeah, so we wrote a letter to the White House. We've been raising this in every conversation that we've had with our colleagues, both at the White House as well as in the departments of state, Homeland Security, even with Pentagon colleagues. So we have about 20% of the applications that are currently in the pipeline. They've received final approval, and so they're moving through the immigration process. Unfortunately, 50% of the SIV applications are only at the initial stages of the process. And then the remaining 30% are awaiting basically chief of mission approval. So we know that there are going to be tens of thousands of these individuals who come September 11th, they will be just waiting in the wings. We know also that Afghanistan has been hit by a severe wave of COVID-19 cases, so severe that the U.S. has temporarily shut down its embassy in Kabul, including all visa processing, is an announcement that was made just in the last week. Meanwhile, Taliban attacks are escalating as they gain territory and power. And so this is where this issue needs to have attention at the highest levels. It's also an issue area where there is strong bipartisan support. And so our point is, first, we need to make sure that the existing authorities, the existing allotments for SIVs, are used to their fullest. We shouldn't be lagging so significantly behind as we are, where only a third or a half of the allotments for SIVs will be used. But we also have been heartened by the fact that we have bipartisan support to increase the number of SIVs that would be allowed to come to the United States. So just in the last few weeks, we had legislation proposed by 10 Democrats and 6 Republicans that would increase the number of SIVs to over 19,000. So, you know, there has been some support, clearly, from veterans groups, from bipartisan members of Congress. We led a letter that was sent to the White House that had 70 NGOs supporting this from really all walks of life. To me, this is a no-brainer. The question that I regularly get is, why aren't we doing this? You know, Pentagon allies have planned for an evacuation if they get the call, but this is where the White House has to make this call, and they have to make it now.
And what have you heard from the White House? I mean, what's your take on the president's position on this and the folks in his circle?
Yeah, unfortunately, I wouldn't say it's been crickets, but it has been closer to that than bold, swift action. It is clear that they are contemplating all options, but evacuations are not an easy undertaking. So we are looking for bolder action than we have heard from the president. Secretary of State Blinken has commented that they are considering all options, but it looks as though the State Department is looking more to increasing processing. And as I said, that is part of the solution, but it's certainly not the bold necessary action that we have argued for, which is to execute an emergency evacuation of our wartime allies before full U.S. withdrawal.
Let's go to the phones. We have a caller, Lisa, who's on the line from Baltimore. Lisa, welcome to Midday with Krish Vignaraja.
Hello, Ms. Vignaraja. Thank you very much for what you do. I'm actually an American citizen now. But when I was a green card holder, or at least applying for my green card in 2006, I was able to, and you know, you can access the stats of various different applicants. And while I was waiting for my green card, I noticed that there were 28 green cards awarded to Iraqi translators slash fixers after, you know, our invasion, or however you want to characterize it, of Iraq in 2003. And by 2006, we had only awarded 28 visas to those people. And I'm sure there were thousands who had applied. So my point is, I think that there is a certain, what's the word, bias in the system against helping. And you just also brought up about, you know, emergency evacuation. Oh, please, we've all seen the killing fields. We know what it's like when, you know, local cooperatives are trying to get out of a country and they can't. So I think there's something endemic in the system that says, thank you for your service, and then we leave. And it's very difficult to get a green card. But I think at this stage, we have to recognise the fact that we have, you know, we have partners who deserve, not, you know, are entitled, deserve the protection of the United States for what they have done on our behalf. And I think it's also goes to a wider question of even the racism endemic in the system. It only took me 11 months to actually get my green card from the date I put it in to the date I was awarded it. 11 months.
Well, thanks for that perspective, Lisa. I really appreciate it. And Krish Vignaraja, there's a variety of reasons that this has slowed down. I mean, some of them may be administrative, but there certainly are probably some philosophical reasons as well that really are, you know, baked into the batter of the system.
Yeah, and Lisa, thank you for sharing your perspective, and Tom for that great question. It is certainly true that there are bureaucratic intricacies involved that are causing the delay, but our point is that where there is a will, there is a way. We have known that in the past, you know, when we wanted to act boldly, we've been able to do so. So as the former speaker, Melvin, mentioned, you know, in the past, historically, we have taken bold action. What we are advocating for is far from unprecedented. After the fall of Saigon, we evacuated 130,000 Vietnamese refugees to the U.S. via Guam. In 1996, we airlifted 6,600 Iraqi Kurds to Guam. So, you know, to the comments about Iraq and the, you know, massive delays, we recognize some of those delays. And so we actually decided to expedite their removal from a very dangerous, precarious situation and to relocate them to Guam, knowing that it was a U.S. territory. Similarly, in 1999, the U.S. evacuated 20,000 Kosovar Albanians to Fort Dix, New Jersey. And so I think, you know, it is important for us to recognize that there are some bureaucratic, there are some racist delays for why we are seeing the backlogs that we're seeing. But I think it's also important to recognize that this is one of those areas of bipartisan consensus when it comes to immigration, which is saying something, because I think we all know that immigration is such a politicized issue. And I think the reason why we are seeing folks from Ron Johnson to Senator Leahy supporting this is because there are moral, there are foreign policy, there are strategic imperatives all at play. We know that for us to turn our backs and go back on our word would be deeply troubling in terms of the U.S. and the rhetoric around how we are returning to our humanitarian leadership. But it's also important to recognize that these resilient individuals and families, whether they are SIVs or other immigrants, like so many others, they come into our communities and they become essential workers, business owners, community leaders, ultimately our cherished neighbors. And then finally, on a foreign policy perspective, it's important to recognize that these individuals are critical in terms of protecting national security. The truth of the matter is that the U.S. can't fight the threats of the 21st century all by ourselves. We need allies throughout the world to do so. So if our nation is unable or unwilling to uphold the oath we swore and the pledge that we made, it will make it extremely difficult to recruit and retrain the strategic and operational support we'll need in the future.
Yeah, it goes beyond, as you wrote in the post, it goes well beyond just humanitarian leadership, but this could really tie our hands in the future. The next time we have to send out the call for assistance, with things like translators and guides and drivers, etc. So this really could set us up for some deep trouble in the future. We're going to take a quick break right now, and when we come back, we'll talk more broadly about the immigration situation in the United States. We'll talk a little bit about what's going on the southern border. Krish Omara Vignaraja is the president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. We'll have more on the other side of this quick break, and you can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. If you've just joined us, it's Midday on Foreign Relations today. My guest is Krish Omara Vignaraja. She's the president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. So, Krish, what's your take about what's going on at the southern border? We've heard, we've seen the administration do a little bit of flip-flopping, if you will, in terms of their announcements about quotas and what they're going to do, and then they changed their mind. At one point, Mr. Biden seemed to be, you know, maintaining some of the quotas that the Trump administration had, and at another point, he seemed to relax that. He's polling very high on a number of areas. People like the COVID relief program. They like the infrastructure program. They like even the voting rights legislation that the Democrats were just thwarted on yesterday. But the one Achilles heel right now for Mr. Biden is the same Achilles heel that a lot of other presidents have had, and that is the area of immigration. Tell us about the scope of the problem as you see it as we stand here today.
Yeah, it's a mess. I think, you know, the administration is responsible for a part of that. And I think that we have to all recognize where there is opportunity that the administration has done some things really well and other things have either gone to a back burner or they haven't been able to address that head on. But a substantial part of why we're seeing what we're seeing is because we had an immigration system that was decimated over 4 years during the prior administration. And so what that meant was that there were policies like the Remain in Mexico, MPP, as it was called by euphemism, was in place when the Biden administration came in. And so they, you know, acted quickly to remove that. But it meant that we had about 70,000 families that had been turned back at the border without the ability to exercise their legal right, who were really kind of squatting in squalor, waiting for an opportunity. And so it took a little bit of time to process those individuals. But there are other pieces like Title 42, which was a public health emergency executive order instituted as a result of the pandemic, where I think there are some questions of how long will that remain in place? What are the exceptions that are being allowed? And does that make sense? I went down to the southern border. I co-led a delegation of about 50 people who were coming in to see what was going on. So we were in McAllen, Texas, and Reynosa, Mexico. And what it seems is happening is that families with children under the age of 6 who are viewed as vulnerable families are being allowed to enter the U.S. So there is a slow trickle. But still, there are a significant number of families who are essentially in a refugee camp in places like Reynosa, Mexico, Ciudad Juarez, where they are in harm's way. There is no infrastructure. When I visited this camp, essentially a gang operating in the area was charging families to use the porta potty and the shower 12 pesos or about 20 pesos, which is a little less than a dollar or a dollar. And this was just, you know, a couple hundred feet from a very militarized U.S. border where, you know, law and order was very clearly in place. And so I think that what the Biden administration needs to do very quickly is build up a system where there's an ability to process children and families who have a legal right to seek asylum, as they also address the root causes, as they try to institute policies so that there is a strategy to enter kind of the queue to come to the U.S. without the only option being to present at the border. There is a reason why a third of the people who are coming to the border are no longer actually from the region, because the immigration system itself is broken. I think, unfortunately, many people are viewing the southern border as the only way to enter the U.S. And I think that that's a deeply troubling system, because I think on, you know, both sides of the aisle, that is not what we want to see.
What about unaccompanied children? What's the scope of it? As you understand it, there's at least one report, I guess, in the AP a week or so ago. There's as many as 14,500 unaccompanied children in the care of HHS. There's also the Customs and Border Patrol. They've got kids as well. I mean, how do you see the scope of that problem? This is, of course, a humanitarian crisis that, you know, the likes of which we haven't seen in quite a while.
Yeah. And it's a great question, just because even yesterday there was a report that came out in terms of some of the conditions that these children are facing as they enter the U.S. and are on our soil. So just to contextualize it, we have seen a 900% increase in the last several months if you compare it to the last several years. So clearly there is a dire need and a desperation of so many children who, in the last few 4 years, they knew that there was no opportunity to come to the United States as a result of some truly inhumane policies put in place by President Trump, and have seen a glimmer of hope under the Biden administration. These are children who are fleeing truly horrifying conditions in their home countries, from gang violence to extreme poverty, persecution, to the devastating impacts of climate-fueled hurricanes. And our laws do allow them to seek legal relief, as well as to reunite with families. The vast majority of the children who come as unaccompanied children across the border, they actually have family here. And in fact, in our region, you know, Maryland, D.C., Virginia, we have one of the highest proportion of unaccompanied children who come to this region because of their family sponsors being in this region. So in the last several months, we've actually seen about 1,350 children released to sponsors in Maryland alone. And Prince George's County in particular has a significant number of children who have been reunited with their families. We have a unique perspective as LIRS, because we are the only provider that works with Health and Human Services in the office that oversees unaccompanied children, that provides the full range of services to these kids. So when they come out of the Department of Homeland Security custody, what we try to do is provide to them what we would want to provide to any of our children, which is a safe, small, family-centric type of environment. Unfortunately, as we saw a surge of children as high as 20,000 in government custody, we saw these large influx facilities that were established by the Biden administration called emergency intake sites. So these are sites that are not licensed by the states. They are much larger. They're really essentially warehouses. And in court filings just this week, we heard some troubling conditions described by the children. Press have not been allowed in. I myself, when I was in Texas, I asked, given kind of our partnership with Health and Human Services, to see these facilities, and my request was denied. So what we heard from the children was that they were unable to shower or get clean clothes. Multiple instances of children saying that they were served undercooked food, chicken, where, you know, you could still see blood. Children said that they didn't have access to education or recreation. Some facilities didn't even have outdoor areas, so children would go weeks without seeing the sun. And then, you know, the other troubling conditions that were described was they weren't able to access case managers. Case managers are how these children are ultimately able to reunify with a parent or sponsor and to get them out of these warehouse facilities. So many of these children experienced trauma in their home country on the journey up north and as they were crossing the southern border. And so for them not to have access to physical and mental health, I think is really troubling. And it's not surprising when we heard a lot of these children talking about crippling anxiety and panic attacks, some who had been put on suicide watch. And so our point, to the general public is there are ways in which you can engage. We have programs called transitional foster care, where if you are willing to open up your home and heart, we have programs here in Maryland where you can actually foster a child for the few days, the few weeks it takes for us to reunite them with their parent or guardian. And so there are ways in which we can actively engage. We just need to make sure that companies are not profiteering off of these children, that it's instead faith-based and other nonprofit groups whose mission is at its core about taking care of children and families.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes for a very broad conversation, which we're not going to be able to have right now. But why is this? I mean, is it that the administration was caught flat-footed, knowing that the decimation of the HHS and the CBP had been, you know, undertaken for 4 years in the prior administration? I mean, is it just that they're playing catch-up? I mean, they're obviously sending the children to these facilities, but if they're sending them there without enough food, without enough clothes, without enough, organization to get their basic needs met, why is that? I mean, here we are in June. They've been in office since January. What's a reasonable expectation for them to get their act together or to coordinate with people like you're talking about, with individual families who'll take on foster situations, et cetera?
Tom, it's a great question, and I think it's fair to say that the honeymoon period is over or it is close to ending, because you're right. We had initial conversations even before this new year talking about how there was going to be an increased need and we needed to build the capacity, because this isn't something that can happen overnight. Increasing the licensed bed placements for these children, it takes time. But this is where they needed to plan ahead. And I think that was certainly a piece of it, is the decimation of the infrastructure and how it is going to take a little bit of time to rebuild. But those conversations that we needed to have, unfortunately, should have taken place months ago. We are having good conversations now, but we really do need to lean in terms of the services we need to provide. The other piece is that we can't rely, as we are seeing the administration doing, on private contractors with little to no child welfare experience. We saw this under the Trump administration and we called them out on it. We can't allow for contractors, some of whom really come from the private security space, to be taking care of children, because it's not surprising when the children are complaining of a lack of basic humane conditions and the lack of trauma-informed care.
And CNN reporting in just the last few minutes that Vice President Kamala Harris will visit the southern border. This is in the context of pretty steep criticism from Republicans who say that she should have gone earlier. Of course, she just went to Guatemala and had some meetings near the southern border just a few weeks ago. Krish Vignaraja is the president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Krish, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And we'll talk again soon.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, psychedelic drugs are now in the medical spotlight, as clinical trials have shown them to be effective in the treatment of PTSD and other mental disorders. I'll talk with two leading researchers in this emerging field, Dr. Rick Doblin and Dr. Roland Griffiths, the promise and perils of psychedelic psychiatry. That's on deck tomorrow here on Midday. Future City is on the way at the top of the hour with guest host Charles Robinson. Good to see Charles stepping into that role. Don't forget to check out The Daily Dose with Aaron Henkin later today and the Chesapeake Connect podcast. That's the one that I'm hosting, where we have conversations about regionalism in the Baltimore metropolitan area. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate it. Let's talk again tomorrow.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.